I'm Ayelet Waldman.
I'm Paul Waldman.
This is Boundary Issues.
Welcome to Boundary Issues, the podcast where two siblings solve all the world's problems while blaming each other for their own. I'm Paul Waldman.
I'm Ayelet Waldman.
And we have what we hope will be a terrific discussion today.
What we know will be a terrific discussion today.
All about masculinity. And we have a great guest who we're going to get to in a moment. But since we are talking about masculinity today, I have a question.
No, for you. I want to ask my question first.
Okay, go ahead, ask your question first.
You are such a nerd and so not masculine. And we're such a little wimp growing up and then suddenly decided to become like a 100th level Taekwondo brute. My question for you, I guess, is really, what were you trying to prove?
See, here's the thing. I think that you saw me strike out in a Little League baseball game when I was like 8 years old. And ever since, you have said that I have no athletic ability and I'm just this wimp, this nerd. That is stuck in your mind. But yes, when I was in my 20s and 30s, I trained for a long time in Taekwondo, and I did have a black belt. I don't know if, do I still have it? I don't know how that works, actually. It's been quite a while since I stopped training in martial arts. But there was a lot of interesting things that happened that came along with that sort of acquisition of a certain kind of physical prowess that I really do feel like it kind of changed my mindset. Now, I should say, in the years I did it, I did a lot of sparring in class. I participated in tournaments. I never got into a fight. I think the first and only fight I got into when I was in the third grade. But I remember thinking at times, you know, like walking into a restaurant and looking around and saying, I'll bet I could beat up any guy in here. And it was a kind of thrilling feeling. Because after all, you know, martial arts is about achieving the ability to commit acts of violence against other people and dominate other people physically. For all the wonderful things that it gives you, the physical fitness, the mental fitness, there's all kinds of great things that go along with it. The acquisition of complicated skills, like that's what it is ultimately about. And I began to feel a little weird about that, not because I was going around beating people up, but because just that was something that was really appealing to me, knowing that I could, if necessary, dominate other people and especially other men. And I, you know, I ended up stopping my training because of some knee problems and because when our first kid was born, I was spending so much time teaching in the evenings that it kind of took me away from him and I wanted to be home more. But I left with a lot of ambivalence about that whole experience, even as I did really enjoy it. And I do kind of miss that feeling of physical prowess. Now I'm much older and I still do lots of kinds of exercise, but I don't have that. Yeah, well, you can go ahead and try. We've been down that road, you and I, before. It was a significant moment in my life when I realized that I was bigger than you finally, and you had to switch from physical abuse to psychological abuse. That's a whole other story we'll do on another episode. Anyway, I have a question for you. Since we're talking about masculinity, your husband, most people will know, Michael Chabon, he is somebody who I know has thought a lot about masculinity. He wrote a book about fatherhood. Mm-hmm. But when his first novel came out, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, the protagonist was gay. And the So the, I don't want to say universal assumption, but the widespread assumption among people was that, well, if this person wrote a book with a protagonist who was gay or bi or whatever, then he must be a gay man. I would bet that even decades later, people still probably make that assumption about him. I wonder how you feel about that and how he feels about
it. I mean,
that.
For years, the internet assumed that I was his beard. And eventually, with like four children, they're like, I guess they must fuck every once in a while at least. So he's never minded it for a second. The one time it was like a little awkward, I think he did a bookstore event and at a gay bookstore, and they were like, hey, maybe the publisher should have told us you weren't gay. You know, he embraces whatever audience. And it's not just Mysteries of Pittsburgh. Almost all of his novels have gay characters. And but I kind of enjoy it. I kind of enjoy the assumption that people have that, like, he's not masculine and macho. I think that Michael has, I mean, like, you know, in all seriousness, that Taekwondo thing of, like, not using your power seems to be a lot of it, right? The idea, Paul, you got me into Taekwondo. I got a yellow belt. That's where I stopped because my knees collapsed. But there was this whole thing that they're like, you have it, but you don't use it. And that's the sort of energy of it, the masculine energy of it. And I think Mike, that's actually kind of Michael. I mean, he is a very strong, powerful person, but he feels no insecurity about that. So which I guess is probably what we're going to talk about, Natalia, that it doesn't bother him in the least. But yeah, years of, like, at my wedding, one of my friends came up to me and said, Ayelet, are you sure he's not gay? And I'm like, aren't we all on the spectrum of Nagi love?
All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and introduce our guest? Natalia Milman Petrozella is an associate professor. Is that correct still?
Yeah.
at the New School, associate
Which
professor of history
exists.
At the New School.
Yay.
Yes, the New School still exists. Her latest book is Fit Nation, The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession. She is also the co-host of the Past Present podcast, among many other things. And recently, she and Elise Hoag wrote a very interesting article at MSNBC.com about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s presidential campaign and the role of kind of performative masculinity in that campaign and how he is appealing to young men in particular. And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about. So welcome, Natalia.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, maybe we could start with you telling us a little bit about what it was that intrigued you and Elise about what Kennedy was doing and how you think that relates to the way young men in particular are feeling about their own manhood these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny, Elise and I wrote that article together, but we'd never actually met when we connected, like, virtually through a list. We just saw that both of us were commenting. We're kind of commenting on RFK Jr. and also taking him a little more seriously than some of our usual interlocutors were. And so I wrote to her off list and I'm like, oh, I'm thinking about this too. And she's like, do you want to write something together? And, you know, she's such an interesting person because she's at New America now. She was the head of NARAL. So she has a very different perspective than me as a historian. But, you know, we were both taken with the fact that he does have a real appeal to young men in particular. And we wanted to understand that better. I think both of us, I don't want to speak for her, but certainly I, and I think she would say this too, both of us kind of feel that, especially on the left, there tends to be too often, I think, a kind of dismissal of this idea that, like, oh, men are struggling, and for very good reasons. I mean, patriarchy is around us all the time, so I get it. But that he was tapping into something that maybe some of our usual progressive fellow travelers were not picking up on.
You know, it's so interesting because I have two sons. They're 20 and 26. And they're not red-pilled or anything, but I definitely sense in them an attraction towards this kind of, I don't know, embrace of masculinity maybe, or confusion about masculinity. I can't really figure out what it is. Like, they've both gone through periods where they lift a lot of weights. They talk about things that are so, that we think are hilarious, but I actually sort of think dig into something deeper. Do you guys know what mewing is?
Oh, yes,
right?
I do.
Like, weird jaw thing. But they're basically trying to make more masculine jaws, right? To make their jaws stronger so their chins aren't weak. And they talk about it laughing, but at the same time, they also listen to Joe Rogan, you know? Do you have thoughts about where this is coming from? Like, the right blames it on us. Women, feminists, right. We're emasculating. But where do you think it comes from?
So my sense, and I have a son too, so some of this is my life as a scholar, but some of this is, like, mom watching her 14-year-old son, and who is cis and straight, at least as I understand him now to be. But I think what it comes from is the fact that, you know, certainly in kind of progressive environments, young men have grown up being taught, I think, some very good ideas that like patriarchy is a noxious force and that like women make less money and domestic violence is a problem and rape culture is an issue. And all of that is very true. But I think that in some ways, like for these very young boys and men, like the idea that they personally, individually should be carrying any of that burden can feel unfair, right? So I remember when my son was in seventh grade and there was some minor thing that came up and he and some of his guy friends were like, you know, you can't, like the girl's word is always like, always prevails over ours. It was some playground argument or something like that. When you're aware of the larger culture, you're like, dude, no, actually the absolute opposite is true. But when you're like a 12-year-old boy, that feels like, why do the girls always get their voice privileged? And so I think some of it comes from that. And people like Rogan, people like RFK Jr., people like Jordan Peterson, like tap right into that.
Can I ask you, as a historian, has there ever been a time in the history of politics when men were not presenting their physical strength as a qualification for leadership? I mean, obviously, you know, patriarchy goes back to the caves, right? And as this first little bands began to organize, the guy who could beat up all the other guys was the one who became the leader. But now we're supposed to live in a civilized society, but we still see, you know, in American history, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was big on showing how manly he was, and how he could kill animals. And even when you get to the contemporary world where it really doesn't matter, you know, who would win in an arm wrestling contest. But is that just something that has always been there, that there's always been some undercurrent of you should elect this guy or he should be the leader because he is the most physically strong?
Well, it's really interesting. And here's my fitness historian cap coming out because Teddy Roosevelt is like the archetype of this sort of thing, right? He advocated for the strenuous life. It's almost comical. He's like posing with like these fringe jackets and like hunting rifles and everything, right? Talking about in a moment when America is becoming more urban and more kind of a place of the service economy, how important it is for really white boys to tap into that physical savagery and strength. So yeah, there's a consistency to that, but it actually shifts over time because like take someone like JFK. So JFK, who we know struggled with a lot of health problems behind the scenes, he was constantly advocating for like physical fitness and recreational exercise and kind of being fit. He was mocked for that ceaselessly because at that time, the idea that you would like lift weights or go jogging or go for a hike was actually seen as antithetical to being a kind of serious cerebral man. So there is that kind of like push-pull of like what kind of physical strength is seen as desirable and masculine in a leader.
Well, you know, I have a question about how violence relates to all this. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I've been thinking about this idea of how tied in with ideas about manhood the capacity for violence is. You know, I did a post on my Substack, which people can go to, paulwaldman.substack.com. It's called The Cross Section. You know, there was this incident a few months ago where Senator Mark Wayne Mullen and Sean O'Brien, the head of the Teamsters, got into this argument in a congressional hearing where they actually got to the point where they were going to stand up and exchange blows. And Bernie Sanders, not exactly a model of physical virility, said to Mullen, just scolded him and said, sit down, you're a United States senator. So it was never consummated. And I feel like that's a big part of kind of the contradiction of manhood, because we still define it so much as the capacity for violence, whether or not you actually do. But we also live in a society where that stuff is not allowed. And you're not supposed to actually go through with it. You're not supposed to consummate it. And in that post I wrote on my Substack, I went back and looked at this.
paulwaldman.substack.paulwaldman.com. Go on.
Yeah. This is kind of a fascinating cultural artifact. The Kenny Rogers song, Coward of the County, which I just, I could go on about it for 20 minutes. But let me just say, it's this story about a man who is known as the coward of the county because his father convinced him not to get in trouble and wind up in jail like he did by getting into fights. And the fact that he refuses to fight makes him the coward of the county. He's scorned by the community. And then what happens in the song and in the TV movie they made of it is that his girlfriend is gang raped. And then in a redemptive moment, he goes down to the bar and beats up the three brothers who gang raped his girlfriend. And now he is accepted by the community because he's no longer the coward of the county. He is engaged in this kind of redemptive act of violence. So we have the situation where violence is on the one hand, something that is still valued. And we're going to get to Donald Trump, but he talks about it all the time. All the time, he's like, oh, I wish I could punch him in the face, that kind of thing. And yet, men are told on the one hand, you have to have this capacity for violence, and that's what makes you a man, is that you can commit acts of violence. But on the other hand, you're told you're not allowed to. You have to restrain that. So do you think that that contradiction is one of the things that's feeding this kind of idea that boys don't know how to become men and we have this crisis of manhood?
Totally. It's confusing. And I think you guys really hit on something actually in your intro. I was like holding back from getting in on the brother-sister conversation. But this idea that as a man, like you could beat someone up, but you're kind of holding that back or like not using it, that is very powerful. There's this historian named Gail Biederman who calls that kind of manliness, the idea that you have physical strength, but you also have the self-discipline not to kind of succumb to your urges towards violence. I think that remains very powerful. And that's like what you both described feeling in your husband or in yourself. And I think kind of what Bernie Sanders was pointing to of like, your senator is like, great, you could fight each other up, but like get a grip. Civilized people don't do that. But then I think, and often this is associated with a sort of more working class sensibility, that idea that like to be a real man, you kick ass and like only a wimp would hold back, that has traction too. And I think it's gotten more traction in recent years as we saw, who was the guy in Montana who punched like the reporter,
Greg Gianforte,
like that was kind of shocking, right? And then Donald Trump also has sort of brought back some of that, I should say, like lowbrow attitude towards masculinity and violence, like grab him by the pussy, like all of that is a sort of unrestrained masculine urge that he has like reinvigorated, I think, in more sort of respectable circles, or maybe not respectable, but.
Can I ask you about that? Okay, so here, to me, Donald Trump has always read so queeny, like the way he talks, you know, like I listen to him and I'm like, oh, I know that guy, right? Like the way he talks is so effete, which I know lots of guys like that. That's fine. But I look at they have to paste his head on a macho body because his actual body is this dumpy, you know, weak, pathetic guy. So, and his voice is that he talks like Harvey Firestein, you know? So like, I don't understand this, the way that he is. I mean, is it purely because of the things he says, which are so, like you say, ridiculously, you know, like the most trite expression of violence? I want to beat him up, or I want to beat him up, whatever. I can't do a Trump imitation, but I've never had the experience of listening to him and not thinking, oh my God, what are you people hearing?
Before Natalia answers, I want to play a clip. This is Carrie Lake at the recent CPAC convention.
I like a strong man. We got way too many weaklings out there. Let me hear from the ladies out there. We're tired of the beta men. We want some alpha men. And we got a number one alpha man in Donald J. Trump.
Gross. Like, can I just throw up? That's my scholarly opinion. Do you want me to respond to that?
Yes, go ahead.
Point? Yeah, it's such a great question. I mean, one of the things that I've argued in the past is that, like, yeah, Donald Trump is this kind of like aggro masculine guy, but Freudian slip, that he's sort of like dumpy and out of shape. I mean, he says he doesn't exercise. To me, he's actually a throwback to the kind of fat cat model of masculinity of the late 19th century, like almost like a pre-Teddy Roosevelt, when what made you a man to have like access to caloric food and leisure? I mean, there are these gentlemen, fat gentlemen's clubs that I wrote about in Fit Nation in the late 19th century, where literally like the best of society were these fat guys who would get together and they describe like the thin villagers looking on enviously, people who don't have enough food and need to work with their hands all day. And so to me, I mean, Donald Trump is so weird as like a social type, but clearly appeals to some people. He, in terms of masculinity, is that old fat cat type. And then you see also, I think that queeniness is so right. It's his voice, but it's also the fake tan and the carefully like coiffed blonde dyed hair and the thin skinness about getting his best side and whatnot, which is so funny because he's, I think, pretty objectively like hideous looking, yes. right? So yeah, I think all of that plays in and he sort of bucks a lot of trends, except I will say one thing that I think he's like really helped put like initiate and sort of amplify is this whole idea that like real men won't be silenced, right? And real men will not be policed by these like school marmy, politically correct or HR types of people. And I think to that, in that way, he is not just an atypical weirdo. I think he really speaks to something that a lot of people, a lot of men probably feel.
And it shows also that there are a couple of different paths that you can go to achieve that kind of for many people, that sort of ideal of manhood. One is that real kind of physical prowess, having the six-pack abs, being the person on whose body they will then put Donald Trump's head. And another is being, as you say, kind of unconstrained by political correctness and by what women want. And the fact that 24 separate women have accused him of sexual assault. And his response is to basically say, I do what I want. You know, when you're a star, they let you do it. And to any particular accusation, he says, ah, she's a liar. Or he says, she's not my type. As though he can rape people. This particular person is just not hot enough for him to rape. And, you know, he has his supermodel wife and all that. And a lot of people look at that, I think, a lot of men especially. We can talk about how women react to this stuff too. But a lot of men look at that and say, that's what I wish I could be. I wish I was unconstrained by all of this.
My mistake is thinking that the discovering that is going to make people not vote for him. Like, you know, I mean, there is this, because of this anxiety of masculinity, I think there is an attraction to behaving like that, which, okay, this is a little weird, but I have a lot of friends, women in their 50s now, who are dating, who have like post-divorce, and almost to a one, the people they're dating are young men, like guys in their 20s, guys in their 30s. Like, so I actually have to say to my friends, if you're going to date people younger than my sons, I don't want to hear about it, because they get like hit up on Tinder or Field or whatever site they are by these guys like 22, 25, 26, women in their 50s. And so when we're trying to parse that out, the guy will usually say something like, oh, you know what you want. So I have a thought about that too. But I also think that one of the things going on with these guys is that they have a tremendous amount of anxiety when it comes to dating women their own age. And it's not just like, oh, she's going to want to get married. It's that they fear that if they take a step wrong, they'll be accused of sexual assault. And that women our age are so used to being sort of what Amy Schumer once called it, gray area rape. It's like, meh, yeah, I didn't really want to, but I knew if I didn't, it was so much easier to just sleep with him than try to say no, I could be out of there in 10 minutes versus, you know, an hour of debate or whatever, that somehow the perception is we're sort of easier about it, which I think may be true just because of our social context. We didn't ever feel like that saying no was as much of an option. So I do feel like part of the attraction is this kind of perpetual anxiety that you might get. I mean, the way we say it now is you might get Me Too'd. But for younger men, I think it has to do about Title IX and having to go up on charges and, you know, that kind of thing. Do you think that's just a crazy thought?
No, I don't think it's crazy. I'm curious to know if these young men want relationships with older women.
No, they just want
to sleep with them. Yeah. Yeah, my hunch is probably you're right that there's some kind of fear about like all the consent stuff, as you say, and that sort of goes out the window with an older woman who either isn't used to the same norms around like exactly what you're talking about, or who is probably more empowered to just be like, no, and to make it very clear. I actually thought you were going in the direction of a kind of like a Freudian analysis of they like want some sort of motherly figure to take care of them.
No, I don't think so. I think they just want to get laid without, you know, fear.
I think that might be it. I also think, you know, there's good research out there about how younger people are having less sex. And some of that has to do with the fact that all of the images online are like, and porn and online filtered images are so like perfect that they're very intimidated to be in actual intimate relationships. And I wonder if something about being with someone older who one hasn't come up in that media environment, but also ostensibly there's no expectation she's going to look a particular way and maybe she's going to be really excited to just be with a guy who's 30 years old. I think some of that might affect it as well.
Do you think that there's some kind of alternate model of manhood that even liberals can agree on? See, this is, I think, the problem with me as a liberal, I think with a lot of liberals watching this debate play out, is that you have on the one hand, you know, all of these weirdo influencers hawking supplements who were all jacked up on steroids, like the Liver King or whatever that guy was. And then you have these right-wing commentators, you know, people like Tucker Carlson, who are telling you to tan your testicles, who are often, by the way, also
of masculinity, Tucker Carlson. Ooh,
exactly. Hot. Like they're all, you know, he's like a doughy prep school boy. You have, you know, people like Ben Shapiro. They're on the one hand, the heroes of the right-wing, you know, masculinity rhetoric. And then you have also these kind of jacked up guys. But I don't know that they're, if you asked 100 liberals, men or women, like, what do you think an appropriate masculinity could consist of? They would have a hard time giving you an answer. And even, I don't even think conservatives do either. You know, like Senator Josh Hawley put out a book called Manhood. I didn't read it, but I read some of the things that he wrote around it and what he said. And it didn't seem like he actually had any kind of answer for how a man should be. It was all, you know, pretty cliched stuff. And so what's the model of masculinity that like a good liberal should want young men to aspire to?
Well, if I had the answer, I'd have like a real bestseller on my hands here. So I don't think there's one. And I think one thing the right has, I do have some ideas of what that is, but I think one thing that the right has been really successful at and that we on the left have kind of let them do is say like, you know, what's wrong with all these lefties? Like they don't even agree that like a woman or a man exists, right? And all of this sort of like thoughtful commentary for the most part on like how gender is socially constructed comes back to bite us all in the ass when we look like people who like don't even acknowledge that like men and women, like that there's any like there to these gender roles. I think that some of the kind of like traditional masculine traits that we think of being able to provide for a family, of wanting someone who loves you, of wanting to be physically active and athletic, like all of those things are really normal, laudable, wanting to be a leader. I mean, those are kind of conventional masculine traits that I think are really good and that we should be kind of amplifying. And I think it's really, it like really, really upsets me when I see some of those ideas just completely being ceded to the right and taken in the direction of like, oh, you want a woman on your arm? Well, then, you know, she should be 20 years old when you're 50 and you have a right to take her by any means necessary, which is basically like the Trump approach or the Joe Rogan approach or the Andrew Tate approach. And it seems like we should have something in between that and people who are like, gender doesn't exist. And I reject all of that because I think that's really, really disorienting.
I'll tell you the story about one of my sons. So my daughter had a 4th of July party and it was at Vassar. So you weren't allowed to bring flags or wear red, white, and blue. But my son, I know, right? My son came up from the city. He comes up and he sends us these texts. He says he shows up at the party and there are a bunch of guys just standing around the grill staring at it. And they're about to dump an entire thing of lighter fluid onto just cold charcoal. So he like gets it. He like gets the grill lit and he shows them how you do it. And then he says, like he sees them slamming the burger through the grill grates. So he sends this text that says something like, I can't remember exactly. He was like, I am all for gender, you know, the gender as a social construct, the changing gender roles, but somebody needs to know how to light the grill. And I found like my reaction was like,
it's very profound.
I'm a boy who knows how to light the grill, right?
Yeah.
And then I had this thought for this reality show that would be like traditional men, manly men who do manly things like fix cars and light the grill. And they would take this, like, all these sweet, it would be like Queer Eye, but kind of in reverse. It would be like take a bunch of gender non-binary kids and say, hey, okay, now I'm going to teach you how to like cut, split wood and do all the things. And
that's a great idea.
Isn't that a great idea? You would like cross-pollinate. But there is something to that. One of the things I love about my husband is he can fix anything. He can fix anything in the house. When he used to joke that he would go away on book tour, and when he would come back after a couple of weeks, we would all be huddled under a single lamp because all the light bulbs would have blown and we were just, you know, unable to change the light bulb. And it is, you know, it is a traditionally masculine thing. And again, I'm going to refer to my girlfriends who are in these dating relationships. Most of them, they're interested in dom sub, light BDSM. Like they are not looking for guys to dominate in bed. They're looking to be dominated. And I hate even to say that because all of my friends are strong feminists and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I do think it speaks, like I'm not saying Joe Rogan is right or Jordan Peterson is right, but I'm saying that there is something going on with that acting out of power that, like you say, Natanya, I don't think we can dismiss it. I think we need to actually speak to it and be honest about it.
Yeah. And I think there's something about like not being imprisoned by it, right? Like once you liberate from yourself from the idea that this is the only way you can be, then you can take the pieces of it that make sense to you in your relationship or in yourself. I mean, since we're all talking about our husbands here, I mean, we met in 2000, like right after I got out of college. And, you know, my career is in education and his career is in finance. And sometimes I would like beat myself up over the fact that like when we had kids, like I like do all the education stuff and he kind of like, you know, knows where all the money is. And I'm like, that's so gendered. I'm a feminist. I'm such a sellout. And then I'm like, but you know, it actually wouldn't really make sense for me to like take a nighttime accounting course to fill that, to figure that out just, you know, like for the sake of it. And so then, you know, I think over time, once you liberate yourself from the fact that like these roles don't have to be bad, as long as you're not forced into them, then I think it's kind of okay. And like, you know, we do not fit gendered roles in other ways. He's like a design freak. People come over and they're like, you have such a lovely home. And they look at me. I'm like, I would like live in a frat house if it was up to me. Like, you know, he picked all of this. And so I don't know. I do think that's a very like individualistic interpretation of what you're saying. But I do think some of this stuff really is about one's own intimate relationship to oneself and to others, you know, and to the others like in your immediate life.
I can say that I express my manhood mostly through power tools. There's nothing that gives you a charge of testosterone like, you know, firing up the nail gun. But I do want to ask a question about kind of the performative aspect of this. As we say, gender is a social contract, and both men and women have to perform their gender. But I think there is.
Actually, I'm not so sure gender is a social contract. Construct. Well, I mean, we say that. I think elements of gender are socially constructed. But I do think there's something there that we're turning our eyes away from that makes us unreliable. And I think the right is seeing that unreliability and sort of jumping on it and taking advantage of it. But go on.
Here's my question. So, as much as women have to perform womanhood, their gender is not fragile in the way that man's is. So men have to perform manhood, and they have to do it in kind of big, visible ways. And it has this kind of fragility to it, that if you're a man, your manhood can be taken away by your boss if he emasculates you. Just that word emasculate, that we use it all the time. It can be taken away by a romantic rival. It can be taken away by you know, an economic setback. All of these things can make you no longer a man. Like if a woman's husband cheats on her, people don't really say she's not a woman anymore. But this is supposed to happen to men. If bad things happen to them, they lose their manhood. And it also can be very threatened by powerful women. Like talking about Tucker Carlson again, he in 2008, when Hillary Clinton was first running for president, multiple times said on the air that when he sees Hillary Clinton on television, he involuntarily crosses his legs, because just the sight of a powerful woman was going to literally, she was going to reach through the screen and steal his testicles. But my question is there a model of masculinity that doesn't have to be performative, that can be kind of quiet, that you don't have to be constantly demonstrating to women and to other men that you are, in fact, a man.
But there is, right? I mean, there is. Don't we, that what we were talking about earlier, the sort of, but Natalia, what you said, like power and not using it, isn't that a kind, haven't we seen that before? Haven't we seen that kind of traditional, I mean, doesn't it feel traditional in its way?
Traditional in, what do you mean, traditional
like,
in the sense
of? I feel like that's a narrative that we've heard for a long time, like these strong, silent men that could kill you, but don't.
Well, yeah. And I think like we'd be wrong and kind of reductive to say that like being masculine only means the expression of that kind of like violent, aggro, alpha self. Like, I don't think that's actually right. And if you look at the kind of history of dominant masculinity in this country, in many ways, things that used to be considered kind of deviant or effete or so gay now are totally normative for straight men. One of the most common examples of that is fashion, skincare, fitness culture. Like, it used to be the only place that you would see a guy with a six pack would be in a physique magazine that was really a cover for magazines shared by gay men, or on a, like a classical sculpture. Now you look at the cover of Men's Health and it's like, get those six pack abs and like light up the barbecue, right? And like similar with like skincare. Like, I remember in the 1990s, remember metrosexuals, right? And it was sort of like, I think that was like this mainstreaming moment. And now there's like $40 bottles of like cleanser that are marketed next to, I don't know, like axes and work boots and stuff like that. And so I think that does speak to a kind of like shifting and, I don't know, like shifting and expanding definition of like what's acceptable as a kind of straight man. So in that way, I think that like that we've seen progress, but definitely in the last, like in the Trump years and since then, we've seen the resurgence of this like aggro, violent, alpha male masculinity. And that's totally tied, not the fault of, but totally tied to, I think, the amplification of kind of like questioning gender and all the rest that comes from the left. It's a real, in some ways, a real reaction to it.
Yeah, there's always going to be a backlash.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite, I'm going to talk for a minute.
Yes, you can.
One of my favorite little factoids is that in the 1950s, you know, if you think about it, it came out of World War II, you had Rosie the Riveter. Not only were women doing these kind of physical factory jobs, but also you had a transformation of work generally where it was moving into offices. And at one point in the 1950s, when there were only three television networks, there were over 30 primetime Westerns on the air, which are very physical, very violent. The heroes are like a guy who can shoot other men. And it was this obvious kind of backlash to these changing social roles and social norms. And I think that's happening now too, clearly. But you also have that stuff in the middle too, you know, that you can go into the Target and buy beard oil because of course you have a big beard, which is very manly, but you also have to care for it with the proper oils.
Yeah. No, I think you're completely right. And we see that like as there are broader social or political transformations that like change one aspect of men's lived experience, in that case, like desk jobs and like suburban life. Yeah, well, you got to watch a Western to like remind yourself what like real virility is.
There is a reality here, right? It was so funny. Somebody was talking to me about colleges and she said, you know, I'm really worried about my son. I mean, he's a white boy. And I was like, oh, no, honey. A boy, he's going to do way better in the college search because they're so over, the applicants are, the back of the pool is overwhelmingly female. There's a real anxiety when you see, you know, the way schools are structured. It is a lot easier to succeed in school if you're a girl. I mean, I have two kids that are boys and two kids that are girls. And my kids all have ADHD in some form or another, but the way the girls' ADHD was expressed made them much more manageable in the classroom. So they didn't get constant negative feedback. My boys, especially my older son, the way his ADHD was expressed was much more the way we think of hyperactivity, mm-hmm. and he got constant negative feedback in classrooms. So there is that thing that like that boys are falling behind that we hear. There is a certain truth to it, you know?
Oh, I see that in my classrooms all the time. And I see that even with the way each of my kids, one boy and one girl, kind of interacts with the learning environment and how it's structured. Now, one of the things though that I think is so interesting is I absolutely think there's truth to the fact that schools are set up for girls to do better. And we see that in graduation rates and grades and all the rest. But then there's this bigger question, like men still make more money on the dollar than women do. You know, like domestic violence is still a huge issue. Women are still like diminished in so many ways. And so like that as an educator actually like terrifies me, because I'm like, wait, maybe like school doesn't actually matter. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like what is going on here? But yeah, no, I think this is why I get angry at the left, even though the right is doing way worse things, because I'm like, this is a real issue. This isn't just like whining or self-pity. Like there are real challenges that boys are facing right now. And if you're a boy in one of those classrooms, I get it, even though if you know what like patriarchy is, because you have moms or dads like us, it still feels like you're the victim there, because that's your immediate power structure. And so I do really understand that.
But it's a problem for liberals, because you know, you're sort of asking people who have been fighting against and critiquing this thing for so long to then turn around to do 180 degrees and say, okay, well, now you have to think about the problems that men are having. And it's just a really hard thing kind of intellectually to change your focus for.
And also, like Natalia says, yeah, they are having problems, but only up to a point, because, you know, what's that thing that you guys wrote about? They're more CEOs named Michael and James than there are women CEOs. So like at some point it doesn't matter. Like at some point, whatever, you may be only 40% of the law school classrooms, but you're 70% of the partners. So, but it is this kind of dichotomy. It is this kind of this struggle, because at the on the one hand, we don't want to just deny that this thing is happening. We don't want to just say whatever, it doesn't matter. But on the other hand, we want to acknowledge the actual truth that ultimately when it comes to power, I keep thinking about this in terms of Israel and Palestine. And I'm like, where are the women? There are no women in those rooms. There are no women in the negotiating rooms. There are no women in the war cabinet, you know, that kind of thing. Like what would be happening if we actually had a voice? You know, and I don't want to blame this, like you say, on the whole. I mean, I think it's great that people are expressing their gender in different ways and, you know, thinking of themselves as non-binary or trans. I think that's all wonderful that we have this range of vehicles of expression and expressions of identity that are wider and more encompassing. And at the same time, I do think we have to pay attention to the way that comes with the vilification of cis men. I've heard the way that you sit in a carpool and you listen to the way the kids talk about cis men and you're like, okay. And also, yes, they commit most of the crime, most of the violence, but also like, be careful, maybe as mm-hmm. well, be careful of how you're making that large community feel. And maybe that's cowardly, but
no, I think it's realistic. And it's also like listening to what the kids talk about, I think it probably figures largely in all of our minds. And like, it goes multiple ways. There's like what you're talking about of like listening to the sort of casual vilification of cis men. But then like, there's also like, I hear like my kids sometimes like rolling their eyes at like, ugh, like everyone and talking about their pronouns all the time and this and the other. And I'm like, I get that in your little micro, super progressive, like West Village community, that feels like overreach or overdetermined or heavy handed. But like, do you get that like there are places all over the country, like in this state, where trans kids can't go to the bathroom without getting beat up, et cetera. So I think one of the things, I haven't figured it out, although it's more explanatory than like sort of a solution, but like, I think all of us, but especially kids, it's very hard for us to see outside of the kind of like structures that immediately shape our lives. Like I joke at the new school, like, you know, I've been called a couple of times like a campus conservative for taking positions that are like center to like raving socialist literally anywhere else, like literally like 10 blocks away. And that's because in that environment, that's the dominant culture. And I try very hard to see outside of that. Most 12-year-olds aren't trying to see outside of that, understandably, right. And their actions are shaped accordingly. So it's really hard, I think.
All right. Well, have we, over the course of the last 45 minutes, saved and redeemed American masculinity? I'm not sure. What do you think, Ayelid?
Well, I think as long as they're men like you, it's just probably doomed.
Sure. I'm trying to do my part. I, you know.
It's a work in progress. Right. A work in progress.
All right. Well, I think we can end there. Our guest has been Natalia Melman-Petrozella, sharing with us all of her terrific insights. Thank you so much for joining us on Boundary Issues.
Thank you for having me.
Boundary Issues is produced and edited by Paul Waldman. Our music is by Zeke Shabon. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at waldmanpodcast@gmail.com. And this is a listener-supported podcast, so if you'd like to support us, you can go to patreon.com/boundaryissues. See you next time.